Hey everyone, it's Jenny Nash, founder and CEO of Author Accelerator, the company I started more than 10 years ago to lead the emerging book coaching industry. In October, we'll be enrolling a new cohort of certification students who will be going through programs in either fiction, nonfiction, or memoir, and learning the editorial, emotional, and entrepreneurial skills that you need to be a successful book coach. If you've been curious about book coaching and thinking that it might be something you want to do for your next career move, I'd love to teach you more about it. You can go to bookcoaches.com/waitlist to check out a free training I have. That's bookcoaches.com/waitlist. The training is all about how to make money, meaning, and joy out of serving writers. Fall is always a great time to start something new. So if you're feeling called to do this, go check out our training and see if this might be right for you. We'd love to have you join us.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, this is Jess Leahy, and this is the Hashtag Am Writing Podcast. This is the podcast about writing all the things. Short things, long things, poetry, prose, narrative nonfiction, fiction, creative nonfiction, queries, proposals. This is the podcast about writing all the things. More than anything else, this is the podcast about the writing life and about getting the work done. I am Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation, and you can find my journalism at The Atlantic and The Washington Post and my formerly biweekly column at The New York Times. The Parateacher Conference ran for about 3 years. I am joined today by Serena Bowen, who has written 50-odd books. She has written lots and lots of romance, and her most recent addition to the world of publishing has been her thrillers, Dying to Meet You and The Five-Year Lie, and she has a book coming out this fall called Thrown for a Loop. The reason I am recording this intro on my own, which, as you may know if you've been listening, is highly unusual for us, is because I know myself, and I know when I'm really excited to talk to someone on the podcast, I'm going to flub the intro. I'm going to forget something. I'm going to forget to introduce them all together. So today, I'm doing that first so I don't mess it up. A while ago on the podcast, you may have heard Serena and KJ read some books by an author named Tess Gerritsen. I had heard of Tess Gerritsen, but I had never read any of her books. I just hadn't yet. I haven't read Nora Roberts yet. I haven't read, there are lots of authors I haven't read yet, and sometimes you don't even know where to start. So when Serena and KJ recommended Tess Gerritsen's new series set in Maine, the first one being The Spy Coast and the second one being The Summer Guest, I figured I had a good place to start. And, you know, as a New Englander, I love a good book about New England. And that was the start of my interest in Tess Gerritsen's work. I have gone back to the beginning and started with her book, The Surgeon, which was her first book in the series that became the Rizzoli and Isles series, as well as a television show. Tess Gerritsen she's written through 33 books at this point, and as I now know, she has also directed a documentary called Magnificent Beast about pigs, which I listened to this morning while I was vacuuming the house. I loved it. She has a lot to say about genre, about publishing, about second careers, about a writing place, and about process. So let's just jump right into it. I am so excited to introduce to you today, Tess Gerritsen. So from the perspective of what our listeners love, this podcast, the Hashtag Am Writing Podcast, is super geek people who love the nuts and bolts and the dorky details of the writing life. Serena has a past life in finance, and so she tends to be like our, no, but let's talk about the numbers kind of person. I'm just the research super dork, which is why I spent my morning watching your documentary about pigs.
Oh my God.
Beast. I've joked in the past that if I could, I would probably just research things in, you know, maybe there'll be a book out there, maybe there won't, but I would research things and just learn as much as I could. And so I loved your Magnificent Beasts podcast, or documentary. I thought it was fantastic. But one of the reasons that we wanted to talk to you just from the very beginning is that we feel like you do some pretty incredible world building and relationship building with your places and your characters. And so I would love to start there, mainly with the idea of starting with the real nuts and bolts stuff, which is like, what does an average writing day look like for you? And how do you sort of, how do you set that up? What does it look like? If you have an average writing day, maybe you don't.
Well, it's hard to describe an average writing day because every day is, there are days when you sit at your desk and you just, you know, pull your hair. And there are days when you get distracted by the news. And there are many days when I just do not want to write. But when I'm writing, the good days are when my characters are alive and talking to me. And it's you talked about world building and character building. That is really key to me. What are they saying to me? Can I hear their voices? And it sounds a little crazy because I am hearing voices, but it's those voices that really make characters come alive.
You have said in other interviews that you are very much, sorry to those of you who hate the terms, that you are very much a pantser, and you are sitting on this interview with a consummate plotter. Serena is our consummate plotter. So could you talk a little bit about how those voices influence, you know, the pantsing of the book and how that works for you?
Well, I mean, it is weird that I am a pantser, and it's funny. I think that people who are plotters tend to be people who are in finance or in law because they're used to having their ducks lined up. You know, they want everything set up ahead of time, and it makes them feel comfortable. And I think a large part of becoming a pantser is learning to be comfortable with unpredictability, learning to just let things happen and know you're going to take wrong turns, know you're going to end up in blind alleys, and yet just keep on forging ahead and change direction. So I suppose that what helps me become a pantser, as I said, is hearing a character's voice. For instance, when I wrote The Spy Coast, the first thing I heard about that book was Maggie Bird's voice, and she just said, "I'm not the woman I used to be." And that's an opening there, right? Because you want to find out, Maggie, who did you used to be and why do you sound so sad? So a lot of it was just getting into her head and letting her talk about what her day-to-day life is, which is, you know, raising chickens and collecting eggs and being a farmer. And then she does something surprising in that very first chapter. There's a fox that's killing her chickens. So she grabs her rifle and kills it with one shot. And that opens up another thing, like, how are you, a 62-year-old woman, able to take out a rifle and kill a fox with one shot? So it's those things, those revelations of character, when they come out and they tell you something or they show you they have a skill that you weren't aware of, you want to dig deeper and find out, you know, where did they get that skill?
And that is a really fun way to show it. I mean, you're talking today with two people who have also kept chickens.
And had foxes take their chickens, actually. Both
oh, yes,
of us.
Yeah. Because yeah. The two go together.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But yes, I admit I have never shot a fox and maybe wouldn't.
I have yelled very loudly at a fox. And he actually, I have to say, really mad respect for the fox because he took one look at me. He did drop the chicken that I was yelling at him for grabbing. And then he went across the street, around the neighbor's house, around the back of the other neighbor's house, and came at the exact same chicken from the other side of the house where I couldn't see him out the window.
So. Oh, they are so smart. They are so smart.
Yeah, so smart.
I know.
Serena, it sounded like you had something you wanted to add, and I interrupted you when we were talking about pantsing and we were talking about world building and character speaking to you.
Well, I just had thought that it was a lovely moment to explain why I was so excited to read this book after I heard Tess speak at Thriller Fest 2024 in a packed room where there was nowhere to sit except on the floor. You told the audience a little bit of a story from your real life that made you want to write that book. And I wonder if you could tell us what that was. Because for me, I mean, we were only 5 minutes into your talk and I'm like, oh, I'm going to download that tonight.
Well, yes, it was a lot of my books come from ideas that I've been stewing over for years. I have a folder called the Ideas Folder. It's an actual physical manila folder. And if I see something in an article or a newspaper or a magazine, I'll just rip it out and stick it in there. And it sometimes takes a long time before I know how to turn this into a book. So the idea for Spy Coast is a little bit of obscure knowledge that I learned 35 years ago when I first moved to Maine. My husband is a medical doctor. He opened up a practice, and when he would bring in new patients, he would always get an occupational history. And he used to get this answer, this very strange answer from his new patients. They would say, "I used to work for the government, but I can't talk about it." And after he heard that three times, he thought, "What town did we land in, and who are these people?" And we later found out that on our very short street, on one side of us was a retired OSS person, and on the other side was retired CIA. A realtor told us that our town was full of CIA retirees. So, I mean, of course, you want to ask, why did they get here? What are they doing here? What are their lives like? I knew there was a book in there, but I didn't know what that book was. I needed 35 years to come up with the idea. And what I really needed to do was become old and realize that as you get older, especially women, we become invisible. People don't pay attention to us. We are over the hill. You know, everybody looks at the young, pretty chicks. But once you start getting gray hair, you fade into the background. And with that experience myself, I began to think more and more about what it's like to be retired. What is it like to be retired from a job that was maybe dangerous or exciting or something that you really risked your life to achieve? So that was the beginning of the Spy Coast. What happens to CIA retirees, especially women who are now invisible, but that makes them the best spies of all.
Yeah. We did this really cool thing, this really fun thing for us on the hashtag I'm Writing podcast. It's like a supporter only thing where we called First Pages, where very brave authors, very brave writers submit their first page to us. And we talk about it and decide whether or not we'd want to turn the page. And you have an incredible skill on your first pages. You're very, very good at first pages. And the, I was thinking about from the summer guests that you had this wonderful line that I'm going to read now. Purity, Maine, 1972. On the last day of his life, Purity police officer Randy Pelletier ordered a blueberry muffin and a cup of coffee at the Marigold Cafe, which immediately reminded me of my very, very favorite line from all of literature, my very favorite first line, which is Irving's first line from A Prayer for Owen Meany, in which he ruins the story for you right there in the first line. "I am doomed to remember a boy with a wrecked voice, not because of his voice or because he was the smallest person I ever knew or even because he was the instrument of my mother's death, but because he is the reason I believe in God." There's this incredible power to first lines, and I'm sort of wondering, where, how first lines happen for you? Do they happen first? Do they happen last? Do they happen along the way?
First lines usually happen last. I will write the whole book and I'll think something's missing in that first chapter. How do I open this up? And, you know, there are things that make lines immediately hypnotic. And one of those things is an inherent contradiction. Something that makes you think, wait, okay, you start off this way, but then all of a sudden the meaning of that line switches. So, it starts off with, you know, this guy's going to die, but on that last day of his life, he does something very ordinary. He just orders coffee at the local cafe. So I think it's that contradiction that makes us want to read more. It's also a way to end chapters. I think that if you leave your reader with a sense of unease, something is about to go wrong, but they don't know what it is yet, or leave them with an unanswered question, or leave them with, as I said, a contradiction. That is what's page turning. I think that a lot of thriller writers in particular mistake action for being interesting. A car chase on the page is really very boring. But what's interesting is something that you could feel that tension building, but you don't know why.
I have joked sometimes that when I get stuck on a plot, sometimes I will talk at my husband and say, you know, I'm stuck here. And he always says, "And then a giant squid attacked." And And it, of course, I don't write books that take place where this is possible. So, but it never fails to remind me that like external action can sometimes be just, you know, totally pointless. and that if you're stuck, it's because you, one of your dominoes isn't leaning, you know, in the right spot. So, yeah.
Yeah. And it's not as much fun seeing that domino fall as seeing it go slowly tilting over. That's, you know, I really learned this when I was watching a James Bond movie. And it starts off, you know, the usual James Bonds have their cold opens, and there's action and chasing and death-defying acts. I find that really, in that movie anyway, I was like, ho-hum, can we get to the story? And I found the time when I was leaning forward in my theater seat, watching every moment, was really a very quiet conversation aboard a train between him and this woman who was going to become his lover. That was fascinating to me. So I think that that transfers to book writing as well. Action is boring.
You and Serena do something that I feel as a writer I would probably not be very good at, which is creating that unease. Serena in particular does this thing. I've read every one of Serena's books, as a good friend is supposed to do. And I text her and I say, why don't they just talk about it and just get it out in the open? And she's like, you know, we just got to make these people uncomfortable. And you both have this incredible talent for helping, keeping the reader along with you, simply because there is this sense of unease. We're slightly off kilter the whole time. And yet in me as a people pleaser, that makes me very uncomfortable. I want people to be happy with each other. So how do you, if you get to a place where you feel like maybe things aren't off kilter enough or things aren't off balance enough, how do you introduce a little bit of unease into your story?
Well, I think it comes down to very small points of conflict, little bits of tension. We call it micro tension. And I think those occur in everyday life all the time. For instance, you know, things that happen that really don't have any big consequence but are still irritating, we will stew about those for a while. And, you know, I used to write romance as well, so I understand entirely what Serena's doing, because romance is really about courtship and conflict. And it's the conflict that makes us keep reading. We know this is a courtship. So there's always that sense of, it's not quite there, because once the characters are happy, the story is over, right?
Yeah. Also, writing the ends of romance novels is the least interesting part. Like, once the conflict is resolved, like, I cannot wait to get out of there.
Right, exactly. You know, I pay attention to my feelings when I'm reading a book, and I've noticed that the books that I remember are not the books with happy endings, because happiness is so fleeting. You know, you can be happy one second, then something terrible will happen, you'll be unhappy. What lasts for us is sadness or the sense of bittersweet. So when I read a book that ends with a bittersweet ending, such as, Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, mm-hmm. I ended up crying at the end of that book, and I have never forgotten that ending. Now, if everybody had been happy and there had been no body to drag all those miles at the end, I would have forgotten that book very quickly. So I think I always try to leave the end of the book either bittersweet. I mean, you want to resolve all the major plot points, but also to leave that sense of unease, because people remember that. And it also helps you if you have a sequel.
That's so interesting. You've just brought up a couple of really interesting points, because there is a thriller. I actually write suspense now, and one of the books that so captured my attention about 5 years ago was killing it on the charts, and I thought it was actually a terrible book, but it nailed the bittersweet ending. Like, the premise was solid, and then the bittersweet ending was perfect, and everything between the first chapter and the last chapter was a hot mess. But but that ending really stuck with me, and I remember carrying around with me, like, wow, they really nailed that ending, you know, and maybe that has, like, legs in terms of, like, talking about it. And, you know, if it's irritating enough, like, the tension is still there enough to, like, make people talk about it, could actually affect the performance of that book. But also, one thing that I really love about the series you have What is this series title for?
The Martini Club.
The Martini Club, right. So the Martini Club is two books now. I inhaled the first one last summer, and I inhaled the second one this summer. And the Martini Club refers to this group of friends of these retired spies. And of course, there are two completely different mysteries that in book one and book two. And I noticed a couple of things about the difference between those mysteries that was really fun. So in the first case, or in one of the two cases, let's see, in one of them, the thing that happens in their town is actually like related to them. Mm-hmm. And in the other one, it's kind of not. Mm-hmm. So to me, that felt like a boundary expansion of your world and your system. But also, I just love the way you leaned into the relationship of these people and their town in such a way. And how did you know to do that? Like, what does your toolbox say about how to get that expansiveness in your character set? Like, you know, to find all the limits of it.
That, you know, so much is like asking a pole vaulter how they do it. they have I guess it's muscle memory. You don't really know how you're doing it. But what I did know was with age, because I love these characters so much, it really became about them and about what is going to deepen their friendship. What kind of a challenge is going to make them lean into each other, lean on each other? That's really what I was writing about, I think, was this circle of friends and what you will do, how much you will sacrifice to make sure your friends are safe. Now, you're right. The second book is much more of a classic mystery. A girl disappears. There were CIA undertones in that because that becomes an important part of the book. But I think that when people say they love this book, they really talk about the characters and that friendship. And we all want friends like this where we can go and have martinis together. And then if one of us needs to, we'll go help them bury a body. I mean, they all have shovels and they're willing to do it. That's the kind of friends we want.
Well, and that's funny you mentioned that. I had an entire question. It wasn't even a question. It was a statement in here about friendships and being grateful to you for the reminder about the importance of relationships. And this entire podcast was born out of the fact that we were talking writing all the time, and we just wanted an official way to sit down once a week and actually talk about the work. And that and your work is suffused with just these incredible relationships, whether that's the Rizzoli and Isles, you know, in your one of your other series. And I'm very grateful for that, because we especially, I think, crave books about female relationships, especially about older female relationships. And I have been loving your books. And may have mentioned to you in my initial email, never read your books before. And I admitted in the introduction that there are lots of very, very famous authors whose books I have never read. And it's always so exciting to me to dive into someone's series and realize, oh, this person really touches on themes that mean a lot to me. And I can already tell that I'm going to be enjoying a lot of their books to come forward. So thank you for all of the great descriptions of relationships and how we do rely on each other for various aspects of just how we get through all of this stuff.
Yes, get through life. But you know what's funny about it is that it didn't start that way. For instance, let's go back to Rizzoli and Isles. The very first time they both appear in a book is in The Apprentice. And they don't start off being friends. They start off they're so different. As the TV producer once said, you've really written about Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock. That's the way they are in the books. They are not natural friends. But like real life, friendships sometimes just kind of develop slowly, and they have their ups and downs. So there are times when Jane and Maura are barely speaking to each other because of conflicts they have. But by the time book 12 comes around, or maybe book 7 comes around, you know that they would risk their lives for each other. So I think that if you're writing a series like Rizzoli and Isles or like The Martini Club, it really helps to develop the friendship on the fly and see how they react to certain stresses. The next book, which I just turned in, called The Shadow Friends, pushes them even further, and it really strains a marriage because it's more about Ingrid and an old lover who comes back into her life. They were both spies, and he is like hot. Antonio Banderas kind of guy. And here's Ingrid married to Lloyd, you know, who's just a sweet analyst who cooks dinner for her every night. And I when I was coming up with that story, I thought, I want to write a book about their marriage. The plot wasn't about, international assassinations, even though that does occur in the book. It's really about the story of a marriage.
And it gives you added unease, if you have your two characters not speaking to each other, and you know your readers love those characters and crave those characters to be getting along at some point, then that's just another reason that we're following along. I was just thinking about Michael Connelly's book the other day, because I really, really like the series he did with Renee Ballard and her relationship with the Bosch character, and how that series is totally about crime, but yet it's also very much about the relationship. And I think I continue to read those because of the relationship between those two human beings, and less so because of the murder mystery sort of stuff.
I think it really becomes important if you're dealing also with Hollywood television series. I still remember what the producer first said when he called me up about Rizzoli and Dials. He said, "I love your girls and I think they belong on TV." He didn't say, "I love your plots." He didn't say, "I love your mysteries," you know, or your intricate ups and downs. It was really about the girls. If you hope to sell to a television series, really it's about characters again.
Absolutely.
I was going to ask about longevity, because you have so many books and you're so obviously still invigorated by the process, or there wouldn't be a book three that you just turned in. So, how have you been able to avoid just being sick to death of writing suspense novel after suspense novel?
I refused. That's what it is. And, I guess I could say that I have a little bit of ADHD when it comes to the books I write. I cannot, after 13 books of Rizzoli and Dials, I just had a different idea. And it takes a certain amount of backbone to say no to your publisher, to your editor, to people who are going, "Well, when's the next one of this series coming out?" And to be able to say, "I need a break. I need to do something completely different." So over how many years I've been a writer, almost 40 now, I've written science fiction and historicals and a ghost story and romantic suspense and spy novels and medical thrillers and crime novels. I've been all over the place. But each one of those books that took me out of what I was expected to do was so invigorating. It was a book that I needed to write. As an example, I wrote a book called Playing with Fire. Nobody wanted that book. Nobody expected that book. It was a historical about World War II and about music, about the power of music and having to do with the death camps. I remember... my publisher going, "What are you doing?" it's true. They are marketers, and they understood that that book would not sell as well, and it didn't. But it still remains one of my favorite books. And when you want to write a book, you need to write that book. That's all. Even if nobody wants it.
I'm so pleased that this came up, because that was actually going to be my question, because both you and Serena have done 90 degrees, whether it's out of, one genre into another. And that, to me, requires an enormous amount of courage, because you have people expecting things from you, and you in particular, Tess, have people saying, "No, I want the next one. I love this relationship. I want the next one." You're not just dealing with the disappointment of whether it's an agent or an editor, but the disappointment of fans. And that's a pressure as well. So when I used to do journalism, I remember a question I asked of another journalist was, how do you continue to write without fear of the comment section? And essentially for us, that's those are our readers. So how do you find that thing within yourself to say, "No, this really is the thing that I need to be writing now"?
Well, that is it's a really tough decision to buck the trend or buck what everybody's expecting, because there's a thing in publishing called the death spiral. And if your book does not sell well, they will print fewer copies for the next one. And then that won't sell well. So you start, your career starts to go down the drain. And that is a danger every time you step out of your tried and true series and do something out of, you know, completely out of the ordinary. I think the reason I did it was that I really didn't give a damn. it was like, okay, maybe this will kill my career, but I've got to write this book. And it was always with the idea that if my publisher did not want that, I would just self-publish. I would just, you know, find another way to get it out there. And I was warned, rightly so, that your sales will not be good for this book and that it will hurt the next contract. And I understood that, but it was the only way I could keep my career going. Once you get bored and you're trapped in a drawer, I think it shows up in your writing.
I had this very conversation with my agent. My first book did well. And so then, you know, the expectation is I'll write like part two of that, or I'll write something for that exact same audience again. And when I told my agent, I said, you know, this book on substance use prevention in kids, I have to write it, and I'm going to write it even, you know, if I have to go out there and sell it out of the trunk of my car. And she said, okay, then I guess we're doing this. And
yes. And they have the best wishes at heart, and
honestly, I loved my book that did well, but The Addiction Inoculation is the book I'm most proud of, and you know, that's been very important to me.
I often hear from writers that the book that sold the fewest copies were their favorites. Those are the ones that they took a risk on, they put their heart and soul into it, and maybe those hurt their careers, but those are the ones that we end up being proudest of.
I like to remind Serena of that because I do remember we text each other constantly. We have a little group, the three of us, a little group text all day long. And there was, I remember when she first wrote a male-male romance, she was scared. She was really scared that this was going to be too different for her readers. And it ended up being, I think, my favorite book that she's ever written, and also a very important book for her in terms of her career development and growth and what she's loves about the work that she does. And so I like to remind her every once in a while, remember when you said that was really scared you and you weren't sure how your readers were going to handle
right.
it?
Right. Well, I also did that in the middle of a series. And I went looking for confirmation that that is a thing that people did sometimes. And it was not findable. So, you know, that was
what change things up in the middle of a series
in the middle of a series. And anyway, that book still sells.
that is a great act of courage, but it's also an act of confidence in yourself as a writer. There are ways to do it. I think some writers will just adopt a different pen name for something that's way
yeah, you, that,
it's
that
funny
is a
you should say that.
Done.
It's funny
well,
you should no, say
and
that.
No, and I never have done that, but anyway, yeah, that's hard. It's hard to know sometimes.
We entertain it all the time. We do talk about that as an option all the time. Shouldn't we just pick up and do something completely different? One of the things that I mentioned at the top of the podcast about, you know, you went off, not only have you done lots of different things in terms of your writing, but you went off and you did an entire documentary about pigs. I have to ask you where on earth that came from and why. And it is a total delight, as I mentioned, and I have already recommended it to two people that I know also love the topic. But you know, to go off and especially when you usually, as some of us have experienced, our agents saying, so when am I going to see more pages or when am I going to see the next book? And you say, I'm really sorry, but I have to go off and film this documentary about pigs.
Yes. Well, you know, I was an anthropology major in college, and I've always been interested in the pig taboo. I mean, you know, back then, everybody just assumed it was because, yeah, it was disease or they're dirty animals. That's why they're forbidden food. It never quite convinced me, because I'm Chinese American. Asia, you know, Asia loves pork. Why aren't they worried about all that? So I was in Istanbul for a book tour once, and I remember I really wanted bacon, and I couldn't get bacon. And then I thought, okay, I really need to find out why pork is forbidden. This is a cultural and historical mystery that never made sense to me. The explanations just never made sense to me. It cannot be trichinosis. So I told my son that. My son is he's a filmmaker as well, and he just said, "Well, let's do it. We will pose it as a mystery." Because it is a mystery. So it took us probably 2 years to go and you know, we interviewed anthropologists and pet pig owners and archaeologists, actually, to find out what do they say? What is the answer to this? And to us, the answer really just came down to this cultural desire for every tribe to define us versus them. You know, they eat pigs, they're not us. So therefore, they're the enemy. And it was fascinating because we ended up finding out more about pigs than I was expecting. And also finding out that people who have pet pigs can sometimes be a little unusual.
And the people who purchase the clothes for the pigs are also
crazy. Yes, sew outfits for their pigs and sleep with their pigs. And there was one woman who had she slept on the second floor of her house, so she had an elevator for her pig who couldn't make it up the stairs. And you know, ramps to get up onto the bed because they've gotten so fat, they've been overfed. But it was, for me, at the heart of it was a mystery.
As a nonfiction author whose whole entire reason for being is, I don't know, let's find out. I think that's just the most delightful thing. And I loved your framing as, I don't know, we have this question. Let's go out there and just ask people about it and find the experts. And that's, I could just live on that stuff. So
so could I. You know, research is so enticing.
It's the best.
It's enticing. It is. It can get you into trouble because you never write your book. But you're right. Some of us just love to do the research.
Serena actually has taken skating lessons, done glass blowing. What else have you done? Yoga classes and all kinds of things in the pursuit of knowledge for her characters. And I think that's a delight.
Yes, if you can sign up for a class to as part of your research, like, that is just the best day. Like, you know, oh, I must take these ice skating lessons twice a day for 5 months because, yeah, or twice a week, but still.
You must be a good ice skater then.
I'm getting better.
So you never gave them up, I see.
Well, it's fun because she usually writes about hockey, but she has a figure skater coming up in this book that's coming out this fall. And she's like, well, I guess I'm just going to have to learn how to figure skate.
Yeah.
I also, one time I went to see Rebecca Skloot to speak about her big nonfiction, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
Oh, okay.
And she said that all her best ideas had come from moments in her life when she went, wait, what?
Yes.
Yep.
Including for The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Like, she learned about the cells in high school. She was in a high school biology class, and the teacher said, like, this woman died in the 60s, but we're still using her cell. And she said, wait, what? And that's what you made me think of with the pigs. Like, I can't
Well, and also your folder of ideas. I mean, I immediately texted Serena after listening to a podcast where I heard an ad, and the ad made me go, oh, that could be creepy. And then I'm like, okay, this is a plot. This is going in the folder somewhere. And so you have to just think about how those things could unfold over time. And I love the idea of, and even in journalism, there are articles that I've written where I said, this just isn't their time. And then, like, 5 years later, I'll hear something out there and I'm like, okay, finally, it's the time for this thing. And there's a reason you put that article in your idea, in your paper manila folder of ideas.
Well, I think writers we have to be curious. We have to be engaged in what's going on around us because the ideas are everywhere. And I have this, I like to say I have a formula. It's called 2 + 2 = 5. And what that means is sometimes you'll have a piece of information that, you know, there's a book here, but you haven't figured out what to do with it. And you wait for another piece of information from some completely different source and you put them together and they end up being like nuclear fusion. Bigger than the sum of the parts.
Yes. Yeah.
Every book I've ever written works like that. Like, I have one idea that I drag around for like 5 years, and then I have this other idea, and one day I'm like, oh, those two things go together. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think Stephen King mentioned that about Carrie. I think it was like telekinesis, and that usually starts about the time of menstruation. And it was like, boom, there was Carrie. You know, those two things came together. I love that so much. So you mentioned that you have just handed in your next book, and we do not, as a rule, ask about what's next for an author, because I find that to be an incredibly intimidating and horrifying question to be asked. I would love to hear, is this series one that you hope to continue working on, the main series, mainly because we have quite fallen in love with your little town in Maine, in Purity, Maine. Fantastic name for your town, by the way. It's really lovely. It creates such a nice dichotomy for these people who have seen and heard things during their careers that maybe are quite dark, and then they retire to a place called Purity. Is this a place where we can hopefully spend a little bit of time?
Well, I am thinking about book number four now. I have an idea. You know, it starts with an idea and noodling around and trying to figure out what, you know, you start with this horrible situation, then you have to explain it. So that's where I am now. I have this horrible situation, now I have to explain it. So I'm thinking about book four. You never know how long a series is going to go. It's a little tough because I have my characters who are internationally based. I mean, they've been around the world, but then I can't leave behind my local cop who is also a part of this group as well. So I have to, you know, keep an eye out on Maine being the center of most of the action.
Right, because how many international plots can you give Purity, Maine?
That's right, exactly. Well, luckily,
look,
because
Murder, She Wrote. How many things happened to that woman in that small town?
exactly. Well, luckily, because I have so many CIA retirees up here, the international world comes to us. Like the next book, The Shadow Friends, is about a global security conference where one of the speakers gets murdered. And it turns out we have a global security conference right here in our town that was started by CIA 40 years ago. So I'm just piggybacking on reality here, and the spies that are up here think that's very amusing.
That is fantastic, because, you know, the essential problem of writing a suspense novel is that you have to ground it in a reality that everyone is super familiar with, and you have to bring in this explosive bit of action that is unlikely to happen near any of us, and those two things have to fit together correctly. So by putting your retired spies in this tiny town, you have sort of like gifted yourself with that, you know, precise problem solver.
Yeah,
it's reminding us. Yeah.
But there's only so far I can take that. Yes, so I'm not sure what the limits. I think book four is going to take them all overseas, because my local cop, Joe, she's never been out of the country except for Canada. And it's time for her dad to drag her over to Italy and say, your dead mom wanted to come to Italy, so I'm taking you. And of course, cool. Things go wrong in Italy for Joe.
Of course. Well, we're going to keep just banging on about how much we love these books. I think we've already mentioned it in three podcast episodes so far in our What Have You Been Reading Lately That You Really Loved? So we're big fans. And thank you so much for sitting down to talk with us, and to, one of the whole points of our podcast is to flatten the learning curve for other authors. So we hope that that's done a little bit of that for our listeners. And again, thank you so much. Where can people find you and your work if they want to learn a little bit more about Tess Gerritsen and her work?
You can go to tessgerritsen.com, and I try to post as much information there as I can. But I'm also at Blue Sky at Tess Gerritsen, and what is now called X, a legacy person at Tess Gerritsen. Yes.
Thank you so much again. And for everyone out there listening, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output, because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.